like to call into session the February 5th, 2009 session of the House Subcommittee on Workforce Development. Good morning to each of you. We have a number of guests here this morning, some of whom have traveled a considerable distance, and want to thank each of you first for your willingness to attend and share with us some of the good work you're doing, and also recognize the fact that you have traveled far early in the morning. So a double thank you on that. Just so that everyone knows the order in which I'm intending to proceed at this point, I'm going to have up first the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps, then followed by the Northwest Youth Corps, and then a presentation from Bill Kluding, who will be discussing kind of a industrial perspective on some of the apprenticeship discussions that we've had. And batting cleanup will be a Norm Eater from Manufacturing 21. So with that, I'd like to invite up, please, Krista Caldwell and John Asher. And were there any other folks in your panel, just the two of you? Okay, come on up. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Witt and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Krista Caldwell. I am the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. With me today is John Asher, and John is the Director of the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps. On behalf of Commissioner Poyce, we are here to provide information to you about OYCC. John will give you an overview, and then we'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Asher, and I am the director of the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps, a program housed within the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to come before you today and speak about what I believe is the best secret in state government. The Oregon Youth Conservation Corps, OYCC, was created by the legislature in 1987, and it was created with a threefold purpose. The first was to establish a disadvantaged and at-risk youth program to perform conservation work in the most cost-effective manner. The second purpose was to protect, conserve, rehabilitate, and improve the natural, historical, and cultural resources of the state. And the third goal was to increase education, training, and employment opportunities for the purpose of improving work skills, instilling a work ethic, and increasing employability. To accomplish these goals, OYCC has developed two programs. The first is known as the Summer Conservation Corps. These are county-based programs that hire local youth to work on projects that meet an individual community's needs. We'll have at least one crew in each of Oregon's 36 counties during the summer, with many counties having multiple crews. They're primarily focused on work skills. Most of the youth will earn minimum wage and work 6 to 8 weeks. OYCC also offers a regional and residential grant program that will allow an organization that chooses to work beyond county's borders or with kids from outside of the county to participate. And some projects may require a residential component, so that allows us to do this also. Last summer, in 2008, over 600 youth were served statewide in this program. The second program is the Community Stewardship Corps program. And this program is fairly unique to Oregon. I've never heard of another state that has a program like ours. They're school-based programs that work with alternative high schools throughout the state, currently in 18 counties. And we provide both traditional academics and project-based learning projects and combine the two together in the youth's educational plan. We currently have 23 operating programs statewide and 4 planning grants that hope to come on board next year. Youth spend roughly 40% of the time in the traditional classroom. They'll spend 40% of the time on field-based learning projects and hands-on learning, and another 20% of the time kind of integrating the two together. Community Stewardship Corps participants are eligible to earn up to $125 a month in scholarship funds. They can earn up to $1,500 maximum, and they can be used at any accredited 2 to 4 year college or trade school nationwide. Since 1992, OYCC participants have earned about $1.86 million in scholarships, and about 600 youth were served in this program last school year. I won't get into any of the real specific demographics on the youth. You should have received an annual report, and all the specifics for each program are included. I would challenge you to take a look at the very back pages. That's where our 535 partners that we worked with last year are listed. And in each community, some of them are listed by city, county, but those 535 people and organizations allowed us to do what we do. Some of the other things that we do, OYCC and the Business Education Compact developed a standards-based science curriculum over the summer, and it's approved by ODE, Oregon Department of Education, for awarding credit. We provide training for crew leaders and teachers throughout the state, and we also provide grant writing assistance for our programs. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Asher, very much. Yes, Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Just some curiosity questions. If you could kind of profile the, you said about 600 participants. Is that like the maximum amount the program can take at this point, or and do you have a lot more applicants than you can actually take? And then if you could kind of profile the typical person that's accepted into the program. And then one following thing is, can they only participate 1 year, or can they apply to participate more summers?
Chair Witt, Representative Huffman, there is a huge need for these type of programs. And they're usually the first program cut when districts face cuts. Alternative ed is usually more expensive because the staff-student ratios are so much smaller. A lot of the youth in our programs come to us because they aren't successful in a classroom with 35 or 40 students. That works for maybe 80% of the students that show up at your traditional high school. But it's those other youth that need that smaller staff-student ratio. A lot of times these youth that come into our programs, they don't have the family support systems. These aren't the kids that are in band. They're not the kids that are cheerleaders. They don't play school sports usually. In Oregon, we might not have the ethnic diversity of some states, but our socioeconomic diversity is huge. And most of our youth are very low income.
And we do have more demand than we can provide slots and a crew. And you can address the numbers on that, I think.
We cannot even provide funding for every individual that out of those 600 youth that we served last year in the program. We'll have about 280 per day, an average daily membership. Some school districts will allow a youth to stay one term in the program, and then they'll return to the traditional classroom setting after that period of time. Some people will do it by trimester. Some youth will come in, and they stay for a long time. In Mill City, youth are identified as not even making it to the high school. So when they're in middle school, they identify these hands-on learning kids that have not been successful. They identify them, they work with them, they move them into our program during their freshman year, and they will stay in on individual education plans through their senior year when they graduate.
Please. Thank you, Chairman. Couple of follow-ups. So is 15 or 16 the minimum age to enter the program?
We can, Chair Witt, Representative Huffman, we can serve down to 13 years old Most of our youth are from 16 to 18, but we had our age level that we can serve dropped two sessions ago to address these middle school kids not even making it to high school.
And how do they find you? Through guidance counselors, typically? Or
Chair Representative Huffman, they're referred in several different ways. Principals, guidance counselors, teachers. Many times these students will be receiving other services, like under the Workforce Investment Act, Department of Human Services, foster care, runaway homeless youth services. They know about us and they will direct youth into the programs.
Thank you, Representative Huffman. I essentially had that very same question. And before I proceed, I want to call everyone's attention to the annual report handout that we have. And on page 11, it lists the advisory committee members, and we have our own Representative Vescovel is sitting on that advisory, the statewide advisory committee. And Representative Vescovel, you may have something that you'd like to say about what this program does for you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. This program is quite an eye-opener for me, which kind of led into me being on and participating in what we are doing, trying to achieve here. The two things that I remember the most about the alternative schools is the intelligence level of some of these youngsters. And one individual, she was vibrant, intelligent, articulate, was speaking to us, and I finally asked the question, "You really like this school, but why? Why do you like this school versus the regular school?" And without hesitation, her response was, "In this school, they care about me. In the public school, they just push me through and they really don't care." That was very striking to me. The other thing that was very sticks in my mind is the intellectual level of these kids that we're dealing with. We had a poet. We had someone that was very good at music. We had, it's a laundry list of different types of people that have different talents that for some reason were unable to bring that talent forward in the public school section, but in the alternative school they were allowed to. They were allowed to learn on their own. They were allowed to learn at their own pace. And it was very impressive when you see that. The other thing that sticks in my mind was when we were leader in, I think it was Grant County or Gilliam County, I can't remember which one, of putting youth to work for the summer. We were the leader in that county, and that's impressive.
Wow.
The other thing that I see, which, I'll be around speaking with each and every one of us and the representatives and senators, is that our funding source, a lot of this funding source comes from the registration fee on machines for lottery, the amusement machines, the one-armed bandits, stuff like that. And I will be around because that's $10, and it hasn't been changed, I believe, since 1993. I think it's pretty close. But, of course, we pay these kids in the summer program minimum wage. You know what minimum wage has done since 1993? It's doubled. So, therefore, we're going to make a run at, instead of giving $10 out of that pot, give $20 out of that pot. So, Senator Prozanski and I are co-sponsoring that bill.
Very good.
Representative, the registration fee, can you explain how that works and who pays it?
The retailer pays it to have the privilege of having the machine, the gambling machine, in his in their establishment. And so, therefore, we're going to try to. Ron Adams will be around this next week and gathering signatures on that bill. So, Senator Prozanski and I can present it, and maybe we can serve twice as many kids.
This is a tremendous program here, and and offers opportunities for youth that would, absent this program, would probably be lost souls. And I'm just wondering, I know you said that the programs in large part relying upon referrals from guidance counselors, that sort of thing. Is the program well advertised or well known in the schools throughout the state, or are there areas where we could use a little more promotion or whatever?
Chair Witt, I think because we work with the local programs, the youth in each of the counties know who's doing the hiring for the summer programs or what alternative education opportunities are available. They're already calling for this summer. Youth employment was the lowest since the Great Depression last summer. And we see that reflected in the kids that we serve. The amount of juvenile kids involved with the juvenile justice system has increased year by year in our program. Even though they're not a majority of the kids that we serve, there's a lot more opportunity to get into, you know, situations if you're not gainfully employed and active. And in some of our rural counties, there's not a whole lot to do. So there's a lot of work available. It's just a matter of coming up with the money to run the programs.
I see. And it looks like, at least from some of your pictures, and I see some of the names that are involved, that you maybe do a lot of work with some of the watershed councils.
Chair Witt, you are correct. The watershed councils are a huge supporter of our programs, and we work extensively with them throughout the state. John Moriarty is the director of the Watershed Council group. He's a good friend of ours, and we're working together with him on a grant now to provide for some funding for his folks to teach our alternative school youth about streams and rivers, and hope to, if we're allowed this grant, we'll take this traveling aquarium show on the road.
Wow. Well, again, this is just a tremendous program that not only provides opportunities for our youth, but also helps preserve our natural, historic, and cultural icons and resources here in our state. And I just think that that's a tremendous program, and I think a tremendous mission. And I wish you continued success.
Thank you, Chair.
Additional questions or comments? Thank you so very, very much. Certainly appreciate your appearance today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to now call up Pat Riggs Henson and Art Pope. And Pat, I understand you're going to be doing an introduction, but I'd like to call on Representative Holvey to introduce the introducer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for being late. I got stuck behind an accident on I-5 this morning.
Glad that you weren't involved, and glad that you made it.
Yeah, I'm glad I wasn't either. It was a big semi-truck, so it was a slow process. So anyway, I would like to introduce Pat Riggs and Art Pope, who Pat Riggs serves on the board, I believe, of Northwest Youth Corps, and Art Pope is the executive director, and they perform a great service, I think, for our state in their program, giving opportunities for kids at large across the state to participate in outdoor programs, maybe some similar to the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps. I don't believe they're not restricted to at-risk youth, and they are largely a nonprofit. I may have misspoke earlier. I think I said they don't receive public funds. I know they don't receive general fund, but they do get grants, I believe, from the federal government, and they do contract with on a competitive basis with state and federal agencies. But their program is really outstanding and gets kids motivated and gives them some work ethic and some hands-on opportunities in the summer times, especially, and they serve, they do projects all over the Northwest, not just in Oregon, but largely their kids from all over the state participate in this program. So with that, I'll let the presenters go forward.
Chair Witt, committee. I'm Pat Riggs Henson, and I'm the public liaison right now for Northwest Youth Corps. I was on the board for about 6 years, and then would like to come before you to introduce Art Pope, and then as a parent and a grandparent of students that have come through the program, I'd also like to give a small amount of testimony after Art. So I'd like to introduce Art Pope, who is the director and founder of Northwest Youth Corps in out of Eugene, Oregon.
Art? Thank you.
Welcome and good morning to both of you.
Thank you.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, Northwest Youth Corps is about helping youth, all youth, achieve success. There's little doubt that youth today face greater barriers to achieving success than ever before. Daily we read of declining physical fitness, increasing obesity, and growing rates of childhood diabetes. We hear of youth making poor decisions about drugs and alcohol. Failure to complete high school is epidemic, and increasingly employers are finding that youth often lack the skills they need to be successful in the workforce. But, you know, I think we're all familiar with those kind of perspectives and the challenges facing kids. I'm here today to talk about Northwest Youth Corps, a great program doing great things for kids. By way of introduction to Northwest Youth Corps, I'd like to read an excerpt from an essay written this year by Morgan Brennan entitled Truly More Than Just a Job. As I planned for my first Northwest Youth Corps session, I was beyond nervous. My sister had done Northwest Youth Corps about 4 years before, so she shared her stories. But no one can ever explain what Northwest Youth Corps is like. No one. It's just one of those things you have to do on your own, and it's better that way. You either go and experience it for what it is, or you stay home all summer long, most likely doing the same old things with your friends and being bored by the same old routine. NYC made me realize that there is so much more to life. I would never have dreamed that places existed like the ones I saw. I was stuck in a rut and really didn't care about anyone else but myself. I came back with a fat check that would have taken months to get if I'd stayed home. More ambition, amazing friends, even better stories, and memories that would last my entire life. It is truly amazing how 5 weeks can change a person and make them a much better person. If you're thinking about doing Northwest Youth Corps, I can't give you one reason why you shouldn't. It is life-changing, and it will open your eyes to so many wonderful and new things. It's practically a free opportunity to travel, too. You get to see some of the most amazing and gorgeous places in the Northwest. You find new friends, make money for doing fun things, and you really come out with that classic NYC stride. NYC's motto is more than just a job, and they really aren't just saying that. It will be the best job you'll ever have. It is a breathtaking experience that you won't find anywhere else. You realize things about yourself that you might not ever realize in your whole life. I'm one of many alumni who would say, do it. You don't have to know anything about building trails, setting up a white wall tent, how to feed 12 people, or how much iodine to put in a gallon of water. You learn everything there and so much more. Take a chance, a deep breath, and put on those boots. You'll be fine, I promise you. You may never get a chance like this again, so sign up, have fun, make great friends, and discover who you really are. Morgan's essay leaves little doubt that Northwest Youth Corps changes lives. But what is it about Northwest Youth Corps that causes that experience to happen? It's kids getting up off the couch, leaving their electronics behind, stepping out of their comfort zones, taking on a huge challenge, and realizing the incredible pride that comes from doing a hard job and doing it well. Last year, 847 youth completed 361 projects in 5 states for 73 project sponsors. 90-plus crews worked 151,818 hours, traveled 359,187 miles, and wore out more gloves, tents, and Pulaskis than I care to imagine. Over the last 5 years, nearly 5,000 NYCers constructed 230 miles of new trail, completed maintenance on another 1,845 miles. They removed 90,652 feet of fence and constructed 69,784 feet of new fence. They planted 10,680 trees and removed noxious weeds from 4,613 acres. And that doesn't even start to consider miles of roads cleared, campsites restored, riparian areas protected, or habitat rehabilitated. Most simply, NYC hires youth. It's a job. Youth are not sent to Northwest Youth Corps. They have to apply, and each person is hired based on their application. Northwest Youth Corps divides them into teams and puts them to work on reforestation, conservation, and recreation projects. In most of our programs, youth live and work with their teams for 5 weeks. They camp out, cook their own meals, and are responsible for all the chores related to living and working as a team in an outdoor environment. Northwest Youth Corps offers an intense and challenging environment that promotes social growth, the development of basic workforce skills, such as problem solving, conflict resolution, teamwork, communication, punctuality, perseverance, and leadership. It is an environment in which youth discover a sense of self-worth. It is a place where each individual starts to realize their own incredible potential as they successfully meet huge challenges head-on and discover that they can honor a commitment, finish what they start, and do that even when it gets hard. NYC was created in 1984. That first year we served 52 youth and had an operating budget of $92,000. Today we serve nearly 1,000 youth every year, have an operating budget of $3.8 million. Our youth payroll alone last year was $798,000. We operate three different programs, a summer youth program, an alternative high school, and an AmeriCorps program focusing on disaster preparedness. In 2000, NYC was able to bring all of our programs together under one roof with the purchase of an entire elementary school from the Eugene Forget School District. We feel that the NYC experience should be available to all youth and are working to double the size of our summer conservation corps. Attainment of this objective will require funding for tools and equipment and expansion of our base of project partners. On another front, over the last several years, it has become increasingly clear that adult challenges are being faced by younger and younger members of our population. Right now, we're developing a new program specifically designed to meet the needs of 14 and 15-year-old youth. This program will offer the same type of team-based outdoor experience as our summer program, but participants will go home at night rather than camping out. The educational curriculum will focus on financial literacy and the development of life skills. We are currently seeking funding for this program and hope to operate a pilot serving at least 100 youth this year. In closing, let me quote two other alumni whose memories remain strong many years later. Justin Crabtree, now 32, offers this advice to future participants. Keep an open mind and you will realize success beyond your dreams. Be willing to try new things. Be willing to work hard. Never quit and use no excuses. Bronwyn Baz, now 35, comments on the lasting contribution NYC has made to her life. The teamwork, empowerment, and organization that I learned at Northwest Youth Corps gave me the skills that I applied to earn 3 honor degrees. NYC skills helped me get into medical school and helped me get into the residency program of my choice. I've used my leadership skills to lead medical teams in Guatemala. NYC is a major part of why I'm successful today and can build a campfire in any weather. Let me call attention to the materials that we brought to you today. There's a map in the packet that shows the number of youth from each county in Oregon over the last 10 years. And I've also included pamphlets that describe an overview of all our programs, as well as an annual report which lists our donors and project sponsors over the last year. And we work for natural resource and land management agencies and private landowners all over Oregon. And our project base is as diverse as we can possibly make it. Pat and I are here today because we know that Northwest Youth Corps offers youth a vital, life-changing experience. We seek your help in being able to offer this experience to a greater number of Oregon youth. I'd like to say thank you for your time and be happy to answer any questions after Pat has a few words.
So I'm going to switch hats, chair with committee, and be a mom of a young lady that went through the program, and both my grandchildren have gone through the program. And my daughter went through the program not once, but 3 times. She went into the program with a normal 15-year-old attitude towards mother. She still loved dad, but she was trying to break away from mom. And also, you know, kind of a challenge of having been raised in a very union household where I taught her to think for herself and stand up for herself, but forgot to tell her she shouldn't do that to me. So she went into the program and a very strong-willed, and the change that I saw, especially with the ability to communicate and write better, because they do journals and they learn while they're out in the woods for those 6 weeks, 5-6 weeks. But it was the mentoring skills, the skills that said, you know what, you're there to help other people. And she just blossomed. It was so amazing to watch her go in, spend a week without taking a bath, which was unheard of, and also just washing up because they're in the backwoods, but also get up, eat, do a job that's a lot of hard work, come back as a team, feed each other, make their food, go to bed, and get up the next day and do the same thing. I can't tell you how many times I was dragged up to McKinsey Trail to show the piece of the trail that they worked on. 3 times I saw 3 different pieces of the McKinsey Trail because they worked on that trail and there was so much pride. And the kids that she met that had never been camping, they'd never been outside. They never laid in a field and looked up without city lights and saw all the stars. It was just life-changing for so many of them. And it was that soft skill they learned. Did they learn hard skills? Yeah. They know how to use a shovel. They learned everything there was as far as what they were doing and how it affected the ecological balance where they were. But it was those soft skills that made the difference. You get up, you go to work, you earn a living, and you take pride in what you do. And when my grandchildren decided to go to that program, I'll tell you, I just smiled from ear to ear because they're in a generation to where they don't think about as much, you know, being in their, you know, teens and then 20s, about what it would like to give an employer everything because guess what? You were hired to do that. It's a different generation, and it's amazing. So I come before you as a mother and a grandmother and soon to be a great-grandmother to tell you that this program changes lives. And I have 2 weeks ago chose to become staff with NYC because I want to be able to get out there and show people what this program does and what programs like this can give back to your kids. These are kids who are sometimes coming into our school because they're interested in a curriculum that takes what they learn as far as math and reading and applies it to a practical example because they're interested in the ecological well-being of the planet. They really do come in and they're fascinated by being able to work and learn at the same time. I thank you, Chair Witt, and the committee for taking the time to hear us, and I really appreciate that. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I really regret not being here for the OYCC presentation, so I apologize if my questions are a little bit redundant. But, you know, it occurs there's a lot of similarities between these programs, yet I believe the mission of OYCC is, you know, slightly different than what the Northwest Youth Corps is in the kinds of kids that they serve largely. And their mission, and I'm not exactly sure, but I think the OYCC serves disadvantaged youth that oftentimes get directed to those programs because of being disadvantaged or being at risk or coming through judicial processes. Whereas I believe the Northwest Youth Corps is open to, you know, any kids that want to sign up to it. They just have to make that application. And as such, the funding mechanism for OYCC is different than what's experienced by Northwest Youth Corps. And I was wondering if the panel could discuss their challenges with trying to get contracts or be able to perform projects. Not that there seems to be a competition between the two, but it's just a different scenario, and I think our statutes sort of direct monies towards OYCC, and I worry that it disadvantages, you know, programs like this, and I'm just wondering if they could comment on that.
Representative Polvey, our program is primarily supported by the revenues we generate from the work the kids do. Our staff right now are in the process of trying to develop a work schedule of $2.6 million to support our operations for next year. The rest of our budget comes from philanthropic sources, grants, and donations. So the work base is incredibly important to us. It's also, by the way, very important that our kids deliver a top quality product, and that's something that we take an incredible amount of pride in. We never want somebody to say, not a bad job for those kids. We expect those kids to have earn the right to be incredibly proud of whatever work they do by doing it to high standards. So that ties into having a great relationship with our project sponsors. We work with a tremendous diversity, but we need more partnerships, and we're working to develop more partnerships with state agencies to be able to hire more kids. So the more that we can be successful in finding opportunities to put kids to work on jobs that already have funding attached, with our model, the more likely we are to be able to hire more kids, serve more youth.
Vice Chair Huff.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I was sitting here, and it was kind of, you were bringing back memories of your story, because it was probably at least 10 years ago, and I was part of a morning radio show, and my sidekick had a son named Bob that went off to NYC to work for the summer, and he would somehow give her somewhat weekly updates, and so we would visit about that on the morning show about no shower for a week, and those. So I remember those stories. So it was, but a phenomenal experience for Bob.
Yeah.
Some of the same questions I had asked earlier about how do people find you, the typical age, and you touched a little bit on some of those in a new program focus. But how do the kids find you, and typical age, and then do you have any? Maybe not additional testimonies, but kind of a trend of adult successes of the people that have come through the program, and kind of where they tend to end up. Do they end up in certificated programs or higher ed or just good, solid adults in general, or what?
Well, the most candid answer to your question is, we have not had the funding to do extensive follow-up studies, so most of our follow-up studies are more anecdotal. We have an alumni website that we have 1,500 alumni registered on, and so we have access to a lot of follow-up information about the ones that choose to register. We'd love to do more in-depth follow-up studies, but everything indicates that our kids move on to be incredibly successful. They've developed a work ethic, they've developed an education background, and an ability to work as part of a team that seems to repeatedly stand them in good stead. The other thing that I think is very successful about our program is the diversity. We have youth from so many different economic and geographic and educational backgrounds that diversity tends to meld them together as a team and carry forward after they're apart. It lends new perspectives. We have two staff per team that are normally college graduates with degrees in environmental education or outdoor recreation or different kinds of social programs. Those role models also demonstrate to kids that they can move forward. And so in that kind of intense outdoor environment with that bonding, it gives youth a perspective of what they can accomplish in a whole bunch of ways that go beyond just being able to figure out how to move a huge boulder out of a trail. And I think that does move them significantly towards success.
Follow-up question that I just thought of. By nature of the name, I assume that you do branch out beyond Oregon, and that's probably in here, but just do you get into Washington or Idaho? Or
the bulk of our programs operate in Oregon. We have eight teams dedicated, 100 kids dedicated to Washington during the summer, another 80 in Idaho, and we cross the border into Northern California. And although most of our programs in Oregon are in Oregon, we've searched out project partners farther afield so we could serve youth. It's been one of the ways that we've been able to grow our programs is by going where the work is. And so we recruit actively out of any of the areas where we have projects. We also get a lot of youth on the internet. And increasingly, we're getting some of that national diversity where we might have as many as one kid per team on a good year from the East Coast or the Midwest. And so culturally, that adds a lot of interesting conversation to our crews, akin to having teams that are made up of kids from east side, west side, north and south parts of the state. It really does foster that interaction that we're trying to promote and that exchange of ideas.
I kind of missed the one part of the question where I was wondering how youth find you.
Okay.
Well, you'll notice that there's a poster in your packet. We send those to almost every high school in Oregon. We recruit in every media that seems appropriate that we can afford. We work with large corporations like Les Schwab to get stuff in their showrooms. And we work actively on our website, and I think most of our youth come in from the internet. All our materials now are dedicated to funneling kids to our website because we can give them more information, they're cheaper, and it's an immediate process that seems to be important to youth today that are more technically savvy than I ever was. So, and the end result is most come through the internet. The trick is to get them to our website so they can come to us through the internet.
And I think the final question that I had asked OICC was, do you have more applicants than you can actually handle?
We try and tailor the amount of recruitment we do so we don't have to turn too many people down. I think that if we had the opportunity, we could serve many, many more youth. And there's a particular need in the 14 and 15-year-old population. Our program that serves 14 and 15-year-olds traditionally has a huge waiting list and fills up really early. So the opportunity to offer increased services to that group, I think, would be a priority for us.
Representative Denbrough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first, I want to apologize for coming in late. I was doing a presentation somewhere else. So I'm sorry I missed the OICC presentation. But I was sitting here thinking about, in my experience, I've taught for a long time at community college level. I've had a number of students who have been in the youth corps, and that's what they say. So I'm not sure if it's Northwest or Oregon. Often inner city kids, and I was trying to think of what, if I were to put a kind of characterization on them, what they might have in common. I came up with three things, and it's interesting that your comments really echoed that. One was that they tend to have a high level of self-confidence, and a second is a really heightened ability to work well in groups. When they're doing group projects or, you know, giving each other evaluations of their work, they're able to do it in a very productive way. And then the third is just a kind of ability to think outside the box. And, you know, often these are kids who've lived in some ways very sheltered lives in mm-hmm. inner city, and they've seen things, obviously, that have expanded their horizons. So I found it interesting that your comments really kind of address that directly.
Thank you.
One question that I have is, we talked a lot in our last session, the last couple of weeks, about technical skills that young people can learn through on-the-job training or through shop classes, technical classes, those kinds of things. And I would imagine that the youth in your programs do have the ability to learn a lot of, well, math skills, geometry skills, things like that as they're doing these projects. And I wonder if you could say something about that.
Our programs all have an established education curriculum, and working in partnership with the high schools, all students can get credit for their participation in our programs. So that curriculum will look at conservation education in a variety of ways and also looks at math skills, particularly in our alternative education high school. We have a program that has 60 kids enrolled and 15 staff to work with those 60 kids. And in that program, we've identified that math in particular is a challenge for the that group. And they have six different math classes, which means a pretty small unit size, every day. And we've even modified our field study activities. So rather than going out, the one class they will have that day that's in the classroom will be math before they go to their field study activities, which is either a work experience for the day or a field study for the day. So we have maximized math because that does seem to be a big challenge for those folks. And we make it as much experiential as we can. So it really is hands-on if we can do that. But we found that doing it alone in the field isn't enough, so we have to tie it to the classroom more.
I know that you your program gives youth a lot of life skills. I'm also interested. I know you mentioned payroll. How much would one of the youths earn, and is it based on skills or experience? Does everyone get the same rate? How's that work?
They do get the same rate. Uh-huh. A student in a 5-week program will earn with bonuses $1,255 this year.
Uh-huh. Very good.
And we do have a rather large bonus program that tries to promote the very values that we think are the critical tenets of our program. So safety will earn you a bonus. Don't get hurt. Keep your team safe. Finishing what you start will earn you a bonus. Be there at the end. Make a commitment and honor that commitment. Work every hour your crew works. In other words, don't get sick. And this might seem a little harsh, but they earn that on a weekly basis. So if you get sick, you only lose it for 1 week. But we implemented that because we found that youth weren't really very inclined to tough it out. We saw our staff never get sick, and we're losing all these hours because kids are sick. Well, that's a workforce skill. You need to be able to get up and get on the job.
Yeah.
So we have another bonus for making it through.
Very good. Very good. Additional questions or comments for our panel? Thank you very, very much. Yes, Representative Polby.
Well, just a comment. I know that this has been one of the things we've been hearing about for the last few years, about kids not having the work skills, the work ethic, and, you know, the math skills. And I noticed that this program is specifically focused at those sorts of kids that perhaps aren't looking exactly on a direct path to college, perhaps. I don't know, that's not a correct statement, but kids that want to get those kind of summer programs, and this summer program is just incredible. And I'd urge any of the committee members to visit this program after session is over and see their operations. I don't know how many trucks they send out across the Northwest, but I see them on the highways all the time going throughout the country. And I was surprised to see one up in Idaho, I think. But anyway, it's just an incredible program, and just thought I'm glad the committee took time to recognize this, because now we're all very familiar with OYCC, and this is sort of another program that's out there that I don't think has really been recognized across this state for what they do. So
thank you. And I'd like to thank Representatives Esquivel and Holvey for their advocacy. They are responsible for suggesting that we bring our two panels here this morning. We've certainly learned a great deal. I want to thank both programs for your presentation, but more importantly for the excellent work that you do for youth. And I have known Pat Riggs Henson for a long time, and I know that you're very community service oriented. I didn't know that you were involved in this, but it doesn't surprise me in the least that you would show up here today, given your commitment to public service, years and years and years. And I think that your commitment probably earns you a mutual friend of ours, Irv Fletcher would call the status of a great Oregonian.
No, you're a sweetheart. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's see. Next, Bill's here. I'd like to call up, please, Bill Cluding. We had, I'll tee this up a little bit before as Bill's coming forward. We had received a considerable amount of testimony, I think from a building and construction trades perspective on workforce development. And Bill attends our committee's hearings, I think, just about every day, and has an industrial experience. And and offered to share some of his viewpoints with us. So, Bill, thank you for that offer, and welcome.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Committee, for the record, Bill Clothing Carpenters Industrial Council. You'll have to excuse my voice. I woke up with somebody kicked me in the throat last night or something. But, yes, I never thought I'd be working with displaced workers, but when my mill closed in 2000, that's what I wound up doing. And within the course of 3 years, my total number that I personally worked with was 2,000 people that lost their jobs. And this is where you run into the education factor. The I had people, you know, when you're in your 50s, I'll get off this just a little bit, but when you're in your 50s and you're out of the job and you don't have the education skills, you're really in trouble. And for example, I went to one of our community colleges south of here, and they had a real good diesel program, and I had at least a dozen people that would lined up that would like to take the diesel course. But in the process of this education form, they had to take English and math. Well, that turned them off immediately. I mean, they hadn't been in school in 30 years. And I worked my way up through the different levels of that school, and I finally convinced them this was all trade act money. And money talks when you go into these schools. I said, look, I got these people that will take your class, but they don't want to sit in the classroom on English and math. They want to learn the diesel trade. They're screaming for diesel mechanics. Can we do this and move forward? Well, make a long story short, it did. It worked. All 12 of these people went through the Trade Act Diesel Mechanics School. We swapped some welding and electrical courses for their English and math. They walked out of there with a degree in diesel. Every one of them went to work. And I got one gentleman that's 67 years old, and you can't pry him out of his shop. Now, if we hadn't have done this, all these people would have fell off the edge. And you know, we heard it time and time again. The employers sit up here and say, our main problem is a skilled workforce. We hear the building trade sit up here again and say, our biggest problem is education. What went wrong? I think if we look back, almost every high school, had a row of vocational shops in the back. You know, this kept a lot of people in school. I mean, if they could get out there and spend a couple hours a day in that shop learning metal or welding or whatever. But I look back and I think when those classes start disappearing, so did those kids. When you ask, take 100 sophomores and you ask them, do you plan on going on to a four-year college? I don't think you're going to like the answer. I mean, a lot of them won't, and they'll tell you so. So somehow we got to tweak the rules or something to entice those kids to stay in school. I worked with a lot of people, and I got them into welding, welding courses, carpenter courses through our community colleges, and quite frankly, they didn't like what I wound up having to tell them. When these people come out of these two-year courses, they couldn't hold their job. When they went out on the job site with, they had 2 years of welding in school, they didn't last long, mainly because there was no little workbench, there was no light that they could turn on. They had to hit the ground running, and they were used to this classroom. What I think we need to look at is to restructure our whole thinking on having a skilled workforce. You know, the building trades have had their apprenticeship program since day one. I went through one. If we could get the building trades and the community colleges to sit down and look at what classes the colleges have and what the building trades do and get that training to where they mirror each other. If you're going to a two-year school, you're learning the same thing as if you was out in the field in a building trade, not necessarily sitting in the classroom all day. I mean, you're out, actually out there. I know it's going to be hard to do. It'll probably raise some eyebrows, but if you went through 2 years of school and you come out of there, wouldn't it be feasible for the building trades to accept that person and put him in the third year of apprenticeship instead of making him start at the bottom? I mean, this turns people off right there. Again, I know it would take a lot of restructuring. I don't know how you would do it, but I think in the long run, everybody would sit back and be pleased at the results, because this is how we're going to maintain a skilled workforce. These kids that drop out of high school, they never will become a skilled worker, especially the way our job market is today. Not necessarily today because we're in a downturn, but I mean, we've lost a good base of industrial jobs. So the way you're really going to make it through life is to fall into that category of a skilled workforce. And somehow the state has to step back and figure out how to do this. Thank you. I'll answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Bill. Certainly appreciate your input. Questions or comments? Yes, Representative Eskimo.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Bill, thanks, Bill, for your input. I believe that this committee is trying to approach that. Representative Imbrell and myself are crafting some legislation that we will get. And you left out, I think, a piece there, and that's the K-12 system, the high school system. These youths that are coming out, and we've heard this over and over and over and over again, they lack the ability to read and comprehend. They lack the ability to do basic math skills. So all indication is there's something wrong with the K-12 system and the high school system. We have a disconnect with these kids. We're trying to craft something to where we can get the high schools, the community colleges, as well as the private sector involved in a sit-down session and come up with a plan in order to get these youths from high school into a transition into community college, which in turn goes into the apprenticeship programs with the particular professions. The other thing I think you kind of got around to was we have to bring back respect to the building trades, respect to the blue-collar worker, which has made America what it is, instead of acting like you're a failure if you don't go to college. I think the OYCC and the Northwest Youth Corps is a prime example of teaching children, our youth, the skills of responsibility of not only a job but also of life. And we're getting another disconnect in high schools, but that doesn't really reflect on the high school. It reflects on the fact that the family nucleus is going away. It's non-existent in some parts of our communities. We have some terrible, terrible times in Medford, where I come from, with one parent or no parents and no influence whatsoever. I look at it like I was very, very special because I had parents. A lot of these kids do not have parents. But the overall picture is that this, I think we're trying to achieve what you're asking us to do. Unless I've missed something here, I think that's exactly what we're trying to do, Bill.
Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, yeah, you're exactly right. You're exactly right. That's what I'm asking. Somehow, the structure isn't working today. If I may point at the education system, it's geared to get that senior right into college without a bump in the road. And again, I asked, you know, if out of 100 kids, how many is going to go on to a four-year school? These are the ones you have to stop and look at, because that's our future on-the-ground workforce. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The chair, Representative Dunbar, did you have something?
Yeah, if I could.
Please.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Brother Kluding, it's really great to hear your comments, and a lot of what I'll say will echo Representative Esquivel's, but I'm really intrigued by this notion of greater integration of certainly K-12 and community colleges, but also the labor unions and employers, all working together to give people both theoretical skills and practical skills at the same time. And the idea of them being in the college programs for a couple of years and then moving into a higher level of apprenticeship, you know, I think that that's an intriguing idea. You know, I think it would be great to have that kind of cooperation start from day one, actually, in those programs, so that they're already having on-the-job kind of training that is provided by employers in cooperation with the apprenticeship programs. This situation that we have of these different silos going side by side, in some cases competing for the same dollars, just seems really crazy, and these turf battles. And young people really are the losers here. A lot of those people that you mentioned who go where everything is geared towards college, many of them do go directly to college, and they drop out of college within a semester or two, and then they eventually come back into some kind of education system. If there are ways that we can get them motivated to pursue alternatives up front, I think that would be very useful.
Thank you.
Bill, I'm going to ask you to sit right there just for a minute. The chair admits that I think I probably broke up possibly a panel that Mike Sullivan, did you want to appear with Bill this morning and say a couple of words? I apologize, guys, for just calling Bill up without the team. My apologies to both of you.
Chair Witt, for the record, my name is Mike Sullivan. I'm the lobbyist or political director for the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers. And it's no problem, Mr. Chair. I can't outdo Bill Kluding. No way. I follow him around and I learn a lot. But I think really the whole idea and the essence of this committee, and I like coming here, is because we're trying to promote the idea of opportunity. And that's a big problem. When I was a kid in the south side of the city of Chicago, there were so many summer jobs in the mills that it was a matter of which one did you want to work at. And what Bill and I are really trying to point out to people is our industrial base in the state is going by the by for the demands of the environmental movement or unfair trade and the like. There's really nowhere for a kid in the summer to get experience in a work ethic and how to work. One of the lobbyists in this building works summers at an AWPPW organized plant, and it pays his way through college. And PBS did a really good show with Leo Gerard, the president of the United Steelworkers, and you can still get it online. It's 25 minutes. And he talks about a man he works with in his office who worked summers in a steel mill, paid his whole college. And if his own son today had to do that, he'd still have a debt of $50,000. Mm-hmm. So college is the answer in many ways, yes. But financially, it's also a problem to pay for it unless you have means.
I know I have two kids I'm still paying for, and I got another one coming. But I'm not downing college, but what I understand is that only 25% of the population of the state or nation achieve college, and the majority of them don't work within their major. And so we have created a class of people that are college educated that don't fit in a way. They have to find their niche too. Nothing works better than a trade. And I went through one, it took me 7 years because of layoffs, short work weeks. I was not also the brightest guy on the planet either. I mean, it took time for me to get into it. I had a high school education that was all preparatorial for college. So the math, classroom stuff, but the work ethic I had to learn on a one-on-one with journeymen. And one example, I had an attitude, and an old journeyman said, "You think you're doing me a favor as an apprentice working with me, don't you?" And I said, "Yeah, I do." He said, "Will you sit down all night, don't do anything, and watch?" And all night long, he did a process, what they call two-tooling. He worked two tools at the same time and basically did more work than he and I could have done together, because there's a knack to it and a niche. And it humbled me, and I always remembered that. I never forgot that. The teacher taught the student very well. So, you know, in closing, we need to make this connect. I mean, if Jesus Christ was a carpenter, I think there needs to be respect for the blue-collar workers, Representative Holden. If it worked for him and he has a great deal of respect in this country, I think it's good enough for everybody else. Thank you.
And I would point out, too, Mike, that you are not only have a trade, you've worked in a couple of industrial settings, and you also have a college degree?
Yes, Chairwood, I do, and I'm in the master's program for UMass, but I'll probably be back in 20 years when I'm 82 and completed it. It's harder than you think.
Bill, Bill said something that I wanted to focus on, and or describe something anyways. The fact that I think it was 5 diesel mechanics are a success story. But were it not for the individual attention and your intervention, they may not have been success stories. And I think it points up the need in many instances for folks to have that mentoring, to have someone who sits down with them and helps them chart out a path to success and is there for them to help them through the process to make sure that they achieve that success. And I am very concerned with impending state budgets and a whole lot of other things, that there is going to be a severely diminished role that the state's able to play in that regard. Bill, you did it. You did it through the private sector, but I'm just saying that there appears to be, along with a diminished number of jobs, the potential for a severely diminished opportunity to help the folks that need the help the most.
So, no, Chair, went to that point. But they say they judge society by how we treat our young and our old, and in general, we're really not doing very well. We've lost the idea of social connect. The last one that's really around is Social Security, and we need to understand that those that come behind us may not make the opportunity or the money that we have. And in fact, I believe a generation or two, that's likely to happen. So we have to remember that the kids that come after us, our children and grandchildren, may not have the opportunities that we have had. And so we have to go back and reinvent the wheel, if you will.
Very, very sobering comment. With that, gentlemen, thank you very, very much. Certainly appreciate your perspective, and I think much of what you had underscores the importance of the work that our subcommittee is doing, as well as the individualized focus that Representatives Esquivel and Dembro have for us here in the future. So, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Committee, we'll see you next Tuesday at 8 a.m.
All right. Last on our list today, I'd like to call up Norm Eater, please.
One comment.
Yeah, please.
You know, what we're talking about here is we're dealing with the back part of this education system, and we should be dealing out front. That's what we're talking about. It reminds me of an advertisement I saw, and it was about, believe it or not, an oil filter. And it was, you want to pay me now, when they held up the oil filter, or they showed a picture of an engine laying on the floor, or do you want to pay me later? Because that's what we're doing with our children, is we're working on the later part instead of the filter part. So I think I'm very pleased to be on this committee, because I think we're going to start working on the filter.
Thank you, Representative. I think you probably teed it up very well for our next guest. Welcome, Norm.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. My name is Norm Eater. I'm Executive Director of the Manufacturing 21 Coalition. I could truncate my testimony to make it very short. Hallelujah. The testimony this morning reminds me of how important this issue is, and how important it is that the legislature this session come to terms with the workforce challenges facing the state, not just for the companies that I represent, but for Oregonians who want the jobs that my companies provide. The sole purpose of Manufacturing 21 is to retain the manufacturing base in the state by helping companies gain access to a motivated and skilled workforce, and also to secure a steady flow of applied research and innovation from our universities. So we work both sides of the street, and are interested in both as we've been active for 5 years now. The coalition began 5 years ago, really as an idea of two or three companies that said, we need a voice. Manufacturers in this state have been around since before we were a state, and it's time that that manufacturers organized a voice on issues that, frankly, they had been silent on for many, many years. Over the last 5 years, we've gotten a lot smarter as manufacturers. We've sought to work very closely with the workforce delivery system as it exists. And I want to be very clear. Over the last 5 years, we've seen that system improve. We've seen the employment department respond to our needs by transforming WorkSource Oregon. Has a ways to go, but we have a willing and able department that's done some remarkable things in the last 5 years. The community college system has a long tradition of responding to the needs of not only manufacturers, but of employers and of workers, and they too have launched new curriculum, a variety of programs in direct response to the advocacy of our coalition. So we feel that that's been a very positive thing. And then I also want to note that the local workforce boards across this state have become our strong partners in mobilizing and delivering federal resources to the kinds of efforts that make sense for our companies, and frankly for companies in other clusters around this state. And so it's not that the system is broken, but the system needs help. And Manufacturing 21 and other employers, I believe you will find, are at the table willing to provide that help. We found our voice in tough times 5 years ago. If you think back, we were at the end of the last bubble 5 years ago. And now, once again, the state and our economy finds itself in pretty dire straits. And but even though our companies are reducing workforces today to meet lower demand from their customers, we still have demand for skilled labor. There are still jobs for Oregonians if they have the right skills and the right capabilities. And our interest is making that connection. Earlier this week, or maybe last week, you heard from the Employment Department, who's done some terrific work in focusing our attention on high-demand, high-skilled jobs. And 10 of those 25 top occupations that they identified, 10 of those can be found in any manufacturing, mid-sized manufacturing company. So they've teed it up for us to take a shot at targeting our efforts to direct them to high-skilled, high-wage jobs and getting people in those jobs during these tough times as also well into the future. Immediately after last session, our coalition, with the advice and counsel and help of Chair Witt, began to develop a short list, an action item, action list of things that we think that this legislature and that this committee ought to begin addressing. And we began with a long list of ideas. We had a PowerPoint that ran about 50 pages, I think, and we've whittled them down to a short list of, we believe, good ideas that can be implemented today to help Oregonians today and tomorrow. And I want to thank not only Chair Witt, but Representative Huffman and Representative Holvey, who were part of the interim committee, that helped us whittle that list down. And this became the foundation for a pre-session filing, a committee bill that I hope we'll get a hearing soon, and we'll have an opportunity to talk about those details in the coming weeks. But let me close on just a few critical points. First is the worsening economy makes it imperative that we look at retraining and training of Americans and Oregonians and get them into skilled jobs that offer the best hope of a broad-based recovery. Jobs are the route to a recovery. In considering ways to stimulate the economic recovery, I've been encouraged by what I hear and read in the newspaper with regards to the legislature, but it's very important that workforce become part of any stimulus package that the legislature put together. It needs to be a component of what we do, and it needs to be focused to match jobs and people. I also want to be clear, Manufacturing 21 is not here asking for money for itself or for our companies. We're advocating for workforce training that can tap the human potential to fill job shortages that exist today and that we know are going to exist tomorrow, even after the recovery. And then finally, we want targeted programs. It doesn't make any sense in this moment of crisis to create a large bucket, throw money at it, and hope something good comes out of it. The Employment Department has given us clear direction. They've identified high-demand, high-skilled jobs, and we ought to be thinking about how we match people with those jobs. Thank you very much.
Please, Vice Chair.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Norm. If I could interject a question.
Please do.
Norm and I had talked before we got started, and I think it was our last meeting, Representative Holvey. I had referenced this booklet that WorkSource Oregon recently put out, and Representative Holvey asked me what I was referencing, and Norm just made reference to it a couple of times here. Did everybody get that? Top 20 identified jobs or something like that throughout the state, a booklet. I think it's got a light blue cover from WorkSource Oregon.
I think I received one in my box here a couple of days ago.
I don't think I have.
We can make those. We can make copies of those available to everyone. That's probably
it's outstanding. Yeah,
Representative Huffman, that's a great suggestion. Kemal, you put that on an agenda for making copies to hand out.
If I may, Lori Warner, Director of the Employment Department, and Graham Slater, who is their Chief Statistician, in response to this committee's questions during last session, went to work developing this data. They looked at every skilled every occupation, and there were hundreds of them, and the full report has all of those listed. But if you focus on the top 25, what will jump out at you is that number one is nursing and number two is welders. And if you look at that top 25, they fall broadly into two categories, healthcare and then skilled occupations that, again, you would find in any manufacturing facility.
Representative Huffman just noted that is an amazing roadmap for workforce development. So, again, that whole notion of demand-driven workforce development.
Yes, Representative Dunmore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thanks, Norm. I always appreciate your presentations and look forward to when this bill comes forward. We heard a couple of days ago from contractors and apprenticeship people about the pride that they take in their investment in their workforce. They have, you know, some cents on the dollar the out of their pay goes to a training fund. We've referenced hospitals that are stepping up to the plate in terms of making investments to develop their workforce. And I'm wondering, the organizations that are representative in Manufacturing 21, so how do you see them as part of the solution in terms of actually investing their dollars, you know, through their payroll in the training, development of their existing workers, and then also bringing in new workers?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, Representative Imbro. Every single one, at least to my knowledge, of these manufacturing companies invest significant resources in training, in in-house training, and both through the public system by sometimes it's tuition waivers and tuition subsidies, but also through in-house training where they hire independent trainers to come in and train people either through a variety of professional societies or others who come in and provide training. And I don't have any data for you, but I would be surprised that if you looked at total trainings or skilled-based training in the state, excluded the K-12, you know, the base educational budgets. But if you looked at that training, and if you could acquire the data from the private companies, that you would find that the aggregates would be that private companies would be spending substantial amounts of money, maybe more than we spend on skills-based training in the state through the public system. Again, excluding the base budgets, right, for the institutions. So every single one of them is investing. You know, I'll give you a personal example. My daughter-in-law works for Precision Cast Parts. It was her birthday last week, and we had a birthday party at their house, and she was waving around a certificate that she had just received that day from a training program paid for by Precision Cast Parts, and she had successfully passed level one of the class. And so this is an illustration of what every company does, good times and bad.
Mm-hmm. If I could follow up.
Please.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. And I think that those kinds of things really do make a difference to workers when they're given those kinds of opportunities. I think it would be useful if somebody could do some kind of survey of what exactly is going on in the state as we're developing the big picture of where we want to go, to have a real understanding of, you know, what exactly is happening today. You know, is everybody you know, participating in this effort? And I just think that would be very useful to get rid of some misperceptions that I think are out there about it.
Thank you very much. I just want to recognize the efforts and tremendous amount of resources that Norm personally, the Manufacturing 21 Coalition, CFM, Mr. Conklin is sitting in the back of the room here today, and the individual manufacturers. I mean, we are talking about literally hundreds and hundreds of hours here that this group of folks, led by Norm, have put together in terms of workforce development, and their willingness to assist this committee and the public sector at large in helping to fill the pipeline and helping us to complete our mission. I would also like to recognize the fact that Norm approached me this morning and he said, we can't wait for the actual action to start. And once again, he's very subtly nudging me to move beyond the discussion to boots on the ground. And Norm, I appreciate that prodding very much.
Thank you.
Anything further?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I would just like to reiterate one point that Norm highlighted. Point number two, get it on the record twice. It never hurts. In considering ways to stimulate our economic recovery, state lawmakers should include workforce training for skilled trades as a key component. And Norm and I were talking before committee started that based on Oregon's taxing system, heavily into income tax revenue, the direct conduit
yes.
for that is workforce training and getting people skilled up and working to generate the revenue for the state. So
that's another component, I think, of what Mike Solon was talking about earlier, the job opportunities that he saw as a young man. And with a state that is as dependent as ours is on the income tax for revenue, we don't solve economic development problems. We don't solve workforce problems. We don't solve our revenue problems unless and until we have that pipeline filled and we have people working at good family wage jobs. Thank you very much, Norm. I certainly appreciate it. And if you'll stay around just long enough to hear Kevin's summation of our work plan here that's coming up, we're going to be getting those boots on the ground very shortly.
I have pen ready.
Thank you again very much. Before we go into that, Kevin, would you please let our subcommittee know where we are in terms of your initial investigation into Vestas and their moving their research and development down to Texas.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Members of the committee, with the help of Keith, who's actually been very helpful in moving, getting some of this research put together. One of the issues that was raised, I believe last Thursday, if I'm not mistaken, was the issue of Oregon seeing Vestas move to Texas in their research and development situation. And the question became, why was that? And so one of the issues we've been looking, Keith and I have been trying to piece together, and I would emphasize these are preliminary, lest I say something and walk out of this room and have a bunch of people outside waiting with torches and other things ready to do us in. In which case, it has nothing to do with Keith. That being said, these are some preliminary findings that we've done through research, and again, we are still doing some more investigation, and we hope to have at least a little something put together for the committee members in the next week or so. As I indicated, Houston, Texas was the one who received the research and development plan for Vestas, and it seems that the research that we've seen so far, there's really four big themes that seem to be recurring throughout. One is it appears that there was a real interest on behalf of Vestas to move to kind of an energy environment in terms of a location in which energy, not necessarily just wind production, but energy was a real focus. That was one of the issues that seems to come up again in a number of different articles. A second big issue that came up is with respect to a built-in network that already exists, a coalition of different universities, two of which that kind of reared their head were Texas Tech and also Texas A&M having some programs, and that kind of fed into the third reason, which is a large pool of engineers that had this kind of background, I guess, readily available. Something, I guess, as an aside, the Northeast was also in competition to get the research center, and there was an article bemoaning the fact that here's Harvard and MIT saying, you know, we're interested in having them here as well, and yet you took Texas. And so it sounds like, at least in terms of the research and development center, there was a fairly stiff amount of competition with some rather large programs. The fourth thing that seems to be recurring in what we've seen is with respect to Texas' existing system with respect to wind farm. I think it was T. Boone Pickens had made and part of a component with an energy package that I think he's been promoting, the presence of of wind technology, and I think that was something that also factored into the decision to have them there. I would emphasize, again, these are preliminary findings. They're derived primarily through articles research. We're trying to get a little bit more information, but it seems like there were a number of issues, a number of which in terms of having a pool of engineers readily available, and I think the environment that seemed to be playing a rather large factor. But again, we will continue putting this together and hopefully have a little more information sooner than rather than later. So,
Kevin and Keith, thank you very much. As Oregon continues to grow its energy production, I believe that we will be giving Texas and the Northeast a run for their money. We will become energy central. We are every bit as capable of doing and developing a network as are our competitors. And I'll put up the engineers that we turn out from our public universities, OIT, OSU, Portland State. Now I'm in trouble because I've left somebody out, but I'll put all of those up against any of these other schools. I think that we learn what the challenges are by finding what attracted other companies, and this I think this helps to set this particular roadmap for us as well. So I appreciate to both of your research very much. And now, if you would, Kevin, summarize Tuesday's agenda.
We do have a preview, again, of coming attractions, and yes, the boots are about to hit the ground. One of the bills that we currently have slated is HB 2204, dealing with the Jobs Plus program in the Employment Department. We have a public hearing and possible work session scheduled for Tuesday with respect to that. We'll be looking at that. I understand the Employment Department will be coming in, and I'm sure I'll be in contact with other interested parties. And then we are trying to get the agenda for later in the week as some other bills. Representative Schaffer's committee has sent us a couple, and we're trying to get those scheduled. And obviously, I think as more bills are cranked out of LC, we'll be seeing more and more. So,
and some of those bills, I think, are precisely ones that the Manufacturing 21 mm-hmm. group has had a large input on.
That is correct. And like I said, it's a matter of trying to get the schedules worked together to be able to start presenting them. But we will be we're moving forward with respect to that. So, one other thing, if I may add, we are also in negotiations with the ACE program that was discussed at Tuesday's meeting about possibly scheduling a presentation, maybe having the director of the program and also maybe a student or two come down. That is something that we're trying to get logistically worked out to see if we can get some people down here to maybe expand on that a little bit more. But again, that's we'll see what we can do with Tuesday. If not, that'll be coming in the next, hopefully in the next couple of sessions, depending upon schedules and logistics.
So our subcommittee is moving, transitioning very quickly from its informational phase into its business and bill handling phase. Any questions or comments? I'm seeing and hearing none. I thank everyone for your input today. And with that, we are adjourned until next Tuesday.